As our population grows older, more and more people are engaged in the important work of helping people cross the threshold from life to death with dignity, peace, and as little pain as possible. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with sociologist Carla Erickson of Grinnell College about her new book, How We Die Now: Intimacy and the Work of Dying. She spent time studying those who help care for people in their final stage of life. I'll also talk with Reverend Christine Tinker and Tom Evans, who are residents of a retirement community in Grinnell. And we want to hear your stories as well. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. People are living longer than ever, and many are also spending significantly longer in the final stage of life, sometimes dealing with painful and chronic conditions of old age. This hour, we're going to focus on that final stage of life and the people who work to care for those in that stage. Carla Erickson is here with me today. She's an associate professor of sociology at Grinnell College. She has just published the book, How We Die Now: Intimacy and the Work of Dying. Hello, Carla.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And tell me how you first got interested in this subject. It was through a very personal experience.
Absolutely. My grandparents were both taken care of lovingly by hospice workers. This was also in the Midwest. And I really saw the grace and the clarity that those hospice workers had around changes with our aging bodies and around dying. And I was kind of covetous of what they knew as a death novice myself. And so that began the inquiry. I was particularly interested in nurses' aides because it's not a well-paid position, and yet for many of us, nurses' aides will be some of the last people that we see before we pass away. And so I started looking at nurses' aides, and I trained to be a nurses' aide. And as I got into this research, people kept inviting me further and further into kind of the world of elder care and elder communities. And so it ended up being a different story about what it means to age in community. But that's what got it started, was seeing the profound kind of physical, spiritual, emotional work that people bring to helping other, to ushering other people toward their end, the end of their life.
Well, and when you write about the experience of watching that hospice worker and the work that she could do, you also wrote about how difficult it was for you as family members to try to do all that work, and the tremendous relief that you felt being able to turn those things over to someone who really knew what they were doing so you could focus on being present.
Yeah. And I think that throughout I wanted to turn to the people who I felt had a lot of expertise in this sticky terrain, you know, that the way that we age and die now, it takes so much work and assistance. And there's a lot of things to navigate around shame and filial responsibility and dependency. And so for us, it was a moment of grace where, as a family, when we just kind of let go and welcomed hospice into our life and welcomed these people who were, you know, utterly reliable, but also became confidants. And I was, as somebody who studies work, I thought, what is it like to meet a family at this moment in their journey and then just kind of wade into that family and be a source of strength? And so I just wanted to know more about those workers.
So when you said you trained to be a nurse's aide, so
yeah,
when you set out to learn more, obviously that was one way that you decided to learn more, but as you said, it did morph. What are some of the other ways that you went into to really trying to understand this final stage of life?
Yeah, so I mean, for me, I identify as a feminist ethnographer of labor, and so that means that I do the work that I'm trying to understand. And so I started out by doing the nurse's aide work. But what happened with this project, in part because it took place in a small town in the Midwest, was that people found out I was asking these questions. And so they would invite me to their workplace or their meeting, or they would tell me a story, or they would send me an email in the middle of the night. And so I kept getting invited further and further into thinking more broadly about who these experts were. And so I started interviewing administrators and chaplains. And then I realized that a lot of the studies of elder community talk about the vantage point of just workers, but they don't talk about the residents themselves. The residents are kind of represented by the researcher. And so then I went on to interview and survey most of the residents at Winthrop House. And so I also learned their stories. And so it became what I had hoped hoped it would be was an in the trenches look. And I think it is that, but it's a much more expansive notion about all of the people who move in and out of the work of helping us die. And that includes, of course, unpaid family providers, because it's not like when someone moves into an elder community that your family just kind of disappears. And I think of this as a labor that involves different people with different skill sets and knowledge. And so that's what the story tries to tell, is what does it mean to age and die the way we do now within a community?
Well, and let's talk about some of the transitions that we've gone through, because many of us, if we haven't had recent experience in retirement communities or elder care facilities, we have some old ideas about what those places are like. And of course, there has been a big transition from a time when family cared for family, and then the nursing homes and the other institutions came around. But that has continued to evolve. What do you feel that, and we'll dig into some more specifics in a few minutes, but what do you feel the picture looks like now?
Yeah. Well, I say to audiences when I give talks, this is not your grandmother's nursing home, right? A lot of us carry around images. Some of them are fed by popular culture, some by negative press in the news that continues to kind of publish negative things about elder care facilities. But a lot of it is based on real memories, right? Of visits that we made to places that were not a place that we would want a loved one to move to. And a lot of times we have these ideas that elder communities are places that someone is put. First of all, it's not a choice. And also that they're places for kind of waiting for death, not places for living. And for the most part, I think, I imagine that there are still some places that fit that description somewhere in the U.S. But for the most part, the industry went through a massive cultural change in the 1980s that was very intentional and really looked at taking notions about sustainability and about neighborhoods and what we were learning about cities and peacefulness. And they applied all of that to elder community. And the other thing that's happened then is that we live these much longer lives, right? So we live a lot more years. And so as a result, elder communities are increasingly places where you can age in place. So you may enter as needing no help at all, but you enter into the community. And then as you need, as your needs change over time, you can move from independent living all the way to a full-time care center. So the problem with that is, although the industry has changed dramatically, and there, I think, are many places like Winthrop House. I mean, I think it's special, but I think it represents a certain subsection of the available options. We still are kind of haunted by that notion of a nursing home, you know. And I talk about that explicitly in my book because I held some of those beliefs, and so I wanted to know what the origins of those fears about nursing homes are. And for me, what I think it is we have a lot of fears about decline and about aging and about what's going to happen to the people we love and us at the end of our life. And we end up applying a lot of that to elder care facilities, even though they're places that could be sources of assistance. But we treat them, you know, we hold them at bay because of those larger fears about life and about decline. And, you know.
Now, some of these retirement communities that seem to be wonderful places to live and really experience life and joy in those final years of life are also really, really expensive to live in. What kind of levels of inequality did you find? I mean, I suspect there are large parts of our population that just don't have access to places like that.
Absolutely. So Winthrop House is rather unique in that they have a fund that means that if you move in there, you can stay there forever. So you never get kicked out, as it were, for lack of funds. But what's unusual about Winthrop House is it is in a relatively rural area, and rural spaces are one of the places where you see a lot of inequality, because in most rural environments, you don't have a lot of options, right? Whereas in a city, you are going to have a lot of options, and some of those are going to be foreclosed based on your social class standing and your economic situation. But you do have a lot of different options, right? So some of the inequalities that we see are not just based on income and what you can afford. Clearly, if you're well off, you can have all kinds of options about care. But many of the places, it's sort of like the conversation we're having about colleges right now. Many of the places don't cost as much as they look like they cost. You know, that there's a lot of subsidy and ways for people of different socioeconomic classes to coexist in those kind of environments. But one of the big inequalities that I found in the research is that elders of color, but particularly African Americans, have often had really bad experiences with institutions of this type or with the medical system. And so there can be not only socioeconomic obstacles to joining these kind of communities, but also perceptive qualities in terms of like whether or not it's a place that feels welcoming and inviting and is considered in that way. So there's pretty big differences across lines of racial groups about the percentage of families who do in-home care or who make use of elder communities. And that has to do, like you said, with economic possibilities, but also with experiences, cultural experiences, and other types of inequality on the level of interaction.
And, of course, another one of the inequalities in our society that you point out in your research is that people who are well-off, and in this country, white, tend to live longer than people of other minority groups or of lower socioeconomic levels.
So this was one of the things that was really shocking for myself and my students, and it should not have been. But I think, because I'm a sociologist, I should know that inequality is kind of a constant. But I really had kind of bought hook, line, and sinker this idea that age was a great leveler, right? That there was a way that it kind of leveled out differences. And really, when you look at the data, it's the opposite, right? These inequalities are cumulative. And so women categorically fare not as well as men. And like you said, not only do you have more options if you're a wealthy elder, but you're likely to live longer, right? So it's a little shocking. So even though the average life expectancy in the United States right now is 77, that varies by a full decade. So a white woman in the United States has the average life expectancy of 80 years, and a black man has the average life expectancy of 70. And I just think that that decade, that's profound, right? That from birth, there's that great a disparity. So yeah, it was shocking and disquieting, right, to know how much that marks even the final stages of our life.
Another big shift that we've seen in our society over this same period is the growth of hospice care as well. That is something that has really changed this final stage of life. And you look closely at that as well.
Yeah. And for me, of course, that was the point of entree, because it felt like hospice care was another way of thinking about the final stages of life that I had also – part of why I became really attracted to seeing my grandparents cared for in that way was that I had seen what I would consider bad deaths, in which people had been fighting all the way through. And so they missed opportunities to say goodbye to each other and to really grasp collectively what was happening. And so I think the alternative of hospice, right, the fact that it is in some ways a critique of what Sharon Kaufman calls the heroic pathway of dying. The heroic pathway doesn't always feel heroic. Right? It feels like you're spending a lot of time in an emergency room. And so hospice is this kind of middle ground where you can engage that process of letting go differently. And I think that's shaped a lot of our beliefs. And I think it's laid the groundwork for people to embrace notions about intentional dying and about advanced directives. And hospice has made, you know, a hospice to me is a story of radical change, right? Having just begun in the 1970s, it's really affected our culture profoundly already.
I'm talking with Carla Erickson. She's an associate professor of sociology at Grinnell College. She has just published the book, How We Die Now, Intimacy and the Work of Dying. Coming up in just a moment, I'm going to talk to a couple of individuals who have intimate knowledge of what it's like to live in a retirement community. I'll talk with them in just a moment. And we also want to hear from you, the stories of things that you've gone through with loved ones in your life. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or of course you can post on our Facebook page. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the final stage of life. Carla Erickson is here. She's an associate professor of sociology at Grinnell College, and she's just published the book, How We Die Now, Intimacy and the Work of Dying. And as she was telling us, the work originally focused on the people who work with those in that final stage of life, but then broadened to encompass the communities that people in this country, when they reach those years and that stage, live in. And I have with me now two people who are intimately acquainted with a retirement community. Reverend Christine Tinker is the spiritual care coordinator and also a resident of Mayflower Retirement Community in Grinnell. Reverend Tinker, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity. It's a pleasure.
And also Tom Evans is here. He served for 32 years as an ordained minister of the United Church of Christ. He is also a resident at Mayflower Community in Grinnell. Hello, Tom.
How are you today?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
And I want to start first with talking about the choice of moving into one of these communities. And as Carla was saying, retirement communities have changed a lot in the last 30 years or so. But of course, a lot of us have those ideas in our head about things that we've seen and experienced in the past. And I'm sure that there are institutions that probably still meet those memories of ours. But Reverend Tinker, when you started thinking about moving into a retirement community, what was your thought process?
Well, I think part of my thought process was shaped by my experiences as a young pastor visiting some of the kind of places that you have been describing. I remember I used to have to schedule very strongly to visit residents that I had in them, and I would come away feeling just awful. I want to put them all in my car and drive them home, and that wasn't feasible. But the part that troubled me there was, even though I felt that way, it was just as hard to go back the next time. It wasn't as if being familiar and having compassion and empathy made me want to go and be with them. I still had that negative feeling. So I understand how people feel when they are looking at the process of making changes, and maybe not even as much for the elder in the family, but the children very often have heard these stories, maybe experienced them themselves, and the thought of encouraging a loved one, or not even encouraging, but having to decide this is the last step, this is what's got to happen, is very difficult. In my own life, Carla and I had she gave me an epiphany yesterday. She used a title for me that, can I say, mm-hmm. say it, that I didn't like. She called me a death educator. And it kind of went around my mind all day yesterday. I got in the shower this morning and I'm like, no, Carla, I'm not a death educator. And I realized that what I have become is a life journey educator and coach. I was blessed in the 1970s to actually be at the beginning of the formation of hospice out of the Yale New Haven Hospital with Ed Doberhall and the Reverend Sylvia Lack, and also to have training with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And the first thing she taught us was that you plan, look at how families plan for birth. That is the way we should plan our life and plan for death. And that was very powerful for me. And so part of my journey as a pastor for 37 years was having the joy of being with people, with children, teenagers, marriages, counseling, the whole life process. And as I matured, at least I hope I matured, I got a sense of what it meant to go through all of that. And so as I got into my 40s, I began to realize that I needed to seriously begin to think about what the rest of my life would look like. And so then I looked more carefully at this whole process and looked at communities. And my husband and I actually signed up for the first time for the community that we're in now. I was a pastor in Wilton, Iowa, in 1990, and the community I'm in now, Mayflower Retirement Community, was a ministry of the Iowa Conference, the United Church of Christ, and visited there. And I said to my husband at that point, we need to look at this. So we actually signed to be residents. But my husband had taught for 12 years at TCU, and we loved Texas. And we then began to think about the fact that maybe we would like to move to Texas and retire there. So I took a position there and decided that, no, I really wanted, we wanted to come back to Iowa. And so ended up making that process. But doing a lot of study and having worked with families throughout, I began to look at what I wanted for a community. And Grinnell was a community I wanted to be in, education, music, central to Des Moines and Chicago, not that far from St. Louis. And the culture of that community was a very mixed one. It was a lot like Winthrop House. If you read the lifestyle of the Winthrop House, you could imagine yourself being at Mayflower Community from that. And so we were just sold on it. I was, I was in my late 60s when we actually moved to Mayflower, and I became spiritual care coordinator there. And part of that job that I like and where Color and I met was the fact that I not only deal and work with residents and families as they make these changes, but as spiritual care coordinator, I have an education sort of side to that that I do with families, but also with staff. And I'm just amazed at the dedication of the young women that we have, mostly young women. We do have some men who are dedicated their lives to taking care of the elderly. And that whole integration and the style of life is important. And I wish that people would look from the time they're 40 at what they want for their life and plan. If we don't plan, it doesn't happen. And we do that.
Gave you control over your life. Mm-hmm. And these were very intentional decisions. There weren't mm-hmm. going to be surprises, and you weren't going to find yourself suddenly not able to drive, not able to take care of yourself in a crisis situation.
And the added part is the younger that you move to a retirement community, the more that you become a part of that community and can use your gifts and skills. For example, in our community in Mayflower, many people use their gifts and skills on the campus, but a lot work with the Grinnell College students, take classes there, but actually work with some programs. They tutor in the schools. And so they're very much not just confined to Mayflower community, but they are very much and very active parts of Grinnell community. So it's a seamless change as they age. And when they are unable to participate, they have friends in the community that will come and visit them from the community.
And Tom, let me ask you, you have been at Mayflower now for just over 11 years. How did you make the decision to move there?
For me, it was a combination of factors, but basically an easy one. I worked for 9 years for the Iowa Conference, UCC. I was an associate conference minister in education. My work was mostly with Sunday schools, youth groups, adult education, all kinds of education. And as a member of that staff, we were very, very well acquainted with Mayflower. First of all, many clergy and other members of our churches in Iowa were moving to Mayflower all through those years. There's a funny story about that. I came to visit one time at Mayflower with a friend, also a clergy, and he gave me the tour with my wife. And after we were done, we were going back to Boston where we lived. And I said to my wife as we were driving away, I never want to live there, sitting in the middle of the cornfields in Iowa. Well, lo and behold, many years later, I called him and I said, I want to move in there. And he gave me the director and I could move in within a week, which I did.
Okay? Wow.
And in fact, one of my daughters in Des Moines picked the apartment for me. I never saw it till I got there. At any rate, I already knew Mayflower as a community. I moved in with a lot of friends, both lay people and clergy, who I already knew over the years, and that was just wonderful.
Well, I was going to ask about that because you mentioned being in Boston, and you were talking about being in Texas, Christine. So, you know, there is an importance to the community and to the friends that you have and the family that you have close by, but it sounds like both of you felt like the community you were moving into perhaps was the most important part of that decision, Tom?
Absolutely, yeah. And I cannot emphasize enough what a multi-diverse community it is. It started out as a church home, started by a conference superintendent, like a bishop, for our churches in Iowa. We have an image that this is a home for retired ministers. Well, we have, 15, 17, something like retired ministers, and we turn them over and, you know, they come and go, like me. But the fact is the community is, I think we said the other day, it's 208 residents and 160 staff supporting them. They come from every religion, every kind of tradition, every kind of background, city people, farmers, all kinds of people. Quite a number of retired clergy, retired professors from the college who figure that's a beautiful place to be and who really want to stay in town. They love Grinnell College, and that's a great gift to us.
I do want to get to the phones. If you have a story that you would like to share or questions that you'd like to ask, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This hour, we're exploring the final stage of life. Carla Erickson is an associate professor of sociology at Grinnell College, and she's just published the book, How We Die Now, Intimacy and the Work of Dying. We also have with us today Tom Evans, who's a resident of Mayflower Retirement Community in Grinnell, and Reverend Christine Tinker, who's also a resident there and the spiritual care coordinator there as well. And Karen is on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I am going to reiterate some of the things your guests have already said. My mother, I moved her to Des Moines 3 years ago, 4 years ago maybe, and she died a year and a half after she arrived here. But the point that I really wanted to make was that people need to talk about the fact that they will die. And, you know, one of your guests said when they're 40. Well, my mom certainly talked about this all of her life as she observed her own mother who died nearly 100 years old. And she and as her contemporaries became ill and died, she would say, that is not what I want to happen to me, or this is what I would like to do. And she, over the last 20 years, was very carefully schooling me about the preparations that she had made, finances, her will, body donation, and she was an observer of others. In other words, she recognized that she was going to die. She did end up at hospice at the end and had wonderful care there. But she initiated that process by telling her doctor, no more. She said, I recognize I'm wearing out, and I don't want to pursue any more health care, whatever, and I am ready to go. And I think if we just talked about that, and I, being over 65, I am in the process of thinking about, you know, when I hit 70, even if I'm in good health, as your one guest said, need to move to a place where you have a community made before you need to go so you can establish yourself there and have a support system there. Anyway, I just wanted to share that because I think your guests are right on.
Oh, Karen, thank you so much for sharing that. And, you know, Reverend Tinker, that echoes so much of what you were saying. And do you think that, and Carla, I want your input on this as well, do you think that we've gone through a change, of course, as our society has changed, where people who are reaching this stage of life feel like they are more empowered and can make their own decisions?
I think some people do, and I'm glad. And I compliment you, Karen, and so happy that your mother was a good example and that you're going to make those decisions. I think, as you called in, that's an example of valuable help. As more and more people hear people like Karen, not just the people who are working, it may sound like we're trying to promote, you know, that this really is good. But when families experience it, if people would talk to their friends and their neighbors, use public forums to share their experiences. It's sort of like used car salesmen. They will believe Karen and her experience sometimes more readily than those of us who are in the field because they have a sense that maybe we're trying to promote something. So thank you, Karen.
Well, and just having that conversation about the end of life, about what you want your death to be like? I think that was a subject that was forbidden for many years because if we had that conversation, we were admitting that someone was going to die. Do you think that taboo is starting to disappear?
I think it is to some extent, but there are also a large portion of people that aren't, and we do see them every day, family members, that's true. The two things that are really important, even the younger you are, I would say even as early as 30, is to really think about advance directives and CPR, because in our fast-paced life, those experiences can happen to us, not just when we're 80 or 90, but the whole, just looking at life, you plan your career, you plan your family, you plan your vacation, and this is the last 20, 30 years of your life. I mean, I retired at 65. I had a grandmother, great-grandmother who will be 100. So just look at how many years I will be in semi-hour full retirement. And those years need to be planned.
Tom, you have something quick to add?
I just want to say that my older brother came to Mayflower after I'd been there quite a while, and he died in the health center, and he went through hospice. My wife and I decided to take the hospice training, which is 6 weeks at the hospital in Grinnell, and not because we wanted to be volunteers, but because we wanted to know about hospice. That's a great idea for lots of people.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking this hour with Tom Evans, who's a resident at Mayflower Community in Grinnell. Also, Reverend Christine Tinker. She's a resident at Mayflower as well, and also the spiritual care coordinator there. And Carla Erickson, who's a sociologist at Grinnell College, and she's just published the book, How We Die Now, Intimacy and the Work of Dying. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this hour we are talking about the final stage of life. With me is Carla Erickson. She's an associate professor of sociology at Grinnell College, and she's just published the book, How We Die Now, Intimacy and the Work of Dying. We're also talking not just about death, of course, but also about those final years of life, and we're talking quite a bit about retirement communities. I have two people with me who understand that life very well. Tom Evans served for 32 years as an ordained minister of the United Church of Christ. He's also a resident at Mayflower Retirement Community in Grinnell. And Reverend Christine Tinker is here. She is the spiritual care coordinator at Mayflower and also a resident. And Carla, you didn't get a chance to weigh in on, we were talking about how maybe in society there has been a shift as people have been more empowered in their personal lives, that maybe that is empowering people to make decisions about the end of life as opposed to having someone decide you have to go to a nursing home, being able to plan and decide I will move into a retirement community of my choosing. Did you find that there is a shift? Are different people going through this now? Yeah.
No, that's a great question. Well, as we talked about earlier, I think hospice has infused the culture in certain ways, and certainly the kinds of options available are much more multiple, and you know they're not the same kinds of facilities that they used to be. But I also think we're going through a cultural shift where, I mean, frankly, for a long time, it was just the unpaid work of women to take care of elders. And now when we're looking at these longer life periods, like what Christine was saying, you know, 35 years, we have to do different kinds of financial planning, it turns out, if we're going to live to 100. And we also have to do different, you know, that our bodies are going through different kinds of deaths. The deaths that took our grandparents out aren't the ways that we're going to die. And so we're going to need different kinds of help. And sometimes it's just not reasonable for families to provide that. What I loved about our caller story, Karen, was that you could hear that because of her mom's planning, she had freed her daughter up in so many ways to just be her daughter and to kind of walk with her through a path that made sense to her. And that's the thing that I really learned from this experience is that, you know, not talking about death is kind of like the worst thing that you can do. And so really, as Christine said, treating this as a period of life that you plan for, it can be so liberating and it can create new connections between people. It can be empowering. And it may sound, you know, not right, but it can make death a time of celebration where you acknowledge the beauty of the life cycle. And just as we celebrate the change of seasons, you know, that if you've done that kind of, you know, she talked about her mom kind of repeatedly telling her what she wanted so that it was very clear. And when you've been freed up from that uncertainty and ambiguity, I think you can, you know, you can meet each other at that moment in the same way that you do with birth. So I think if we can kind of wipe away the shadows and the confusion and the lack of knowledge about end of life and really talk about it, I think we can have better deaths. We can have better final final chapters.
We have this email from Stephanie. She says, I just wanted to say that we couldn't be happier with the way our relative, my grandmother, is living since we moved her into a local rest home. For years, she was voluntarily shut in her house because her then-living husband never wanted to go out and be social. Since his unfortunate passing, it was determined that my grandmother shouldn't be alone, and we got her set up at the local elder care facility. Since her transition, she has blossomed. She's been able to socialize the way she loves to, and now has immediate care at hand when she needs it. She's so happy there now, and it almost seems like she's going through what many of us experience when we first go to college. Her diet and medication are seen to by professionals, and we couldn't be more grateful to the staff that see to her needs every day. And Tom, during the break, we were talking about the fact that you have taught a number of computer classes over the years, and you've had elder residents and get involved in your computer classes. And you've probably seen that happen where people have really blossomed in this kind of environment.
Exactly. I was telling the story of a lady I knew for many years who at 101 called me on the phone. I was teaching these senior courses for computers at the community college in Grinnell. And she called and said, Tom, what's the next computer course I should take? Age 101.
Wow. You know, yeah. That's beautiful.
I'd like to add one other thing. One of the unique things about Mayflower, which, as we said, is rather similar to what Winthrop House is like, we have what's called the Mayflower Residents Association. If you think of the old images of the director of a nursing home who's very directive, tells people what they have to do, you know, all that kind of stuff. Not true at Mayflower at all. Our Residents Association, which every resident's a member of, has regular meetings, has bylaws, has all kinds of things. They decide on how we will live at Mayflower together. And that's a remarkable thing in terms of involving people's gifts, urging them on to new life, doing, you know, et cetera. My mother lived in a retirement home community for 22 years, and the motto of that home was where life is added to years. And that's very much true at Mayflower, and the Residents Association helps that to happen.
Right. Well, and I have been struck. A couple of weeks ago, we did a show about longevity in Iowa, and we talked about what centenarians tend to have in common and to, you know, how people can live to be that old and embrace that kind of age. One of the things that seems to be very important is to have purpose in your life. And I was struck in talking to both of you before the show. And Christine, you're spiritual care coordinator. You have a job at Mayflower, although you retired and moved in. And Tom, you were telling me you have served as Mayflower photographer for many years. You've been teaching computer courses and could be involved in clergy if you chose to be at Mayflower. Is that something that Mayflower has done purposely to give people an opportunity to continue to share their gifts and to have purpose in life? Christine?
Yes, we encourage people to socialize. One of the tasks that I have along with our social worker sometimes is to really look at ways in which we can get residents to become people like Stephanie's mother, you know, really connect them to the community. And we have an independent living activities director who works with the Mayflower Residents Association, as well as an activities department with our health center assisted living and memory support units. So it's very important to integrate that. We're also very blessed that the college students, we always have a lot of college students there who help with this, do programs. One of the things that's true about Mayflower residents, and I don't know it was true, I think, about your Winthrop people, but about other homes. But Ashley, sometimes you really can't, as a spiritual care coordinator, I can't just go visit somebody because their schedules are so busy. I have to call and make sure that they have space on their, you know, what's an appropriate time to visit them. And the view that people are sitting around waiting for company or too tired is just not true, I would say. Probably maybe 80% of our residents, at least, active every single day. They go to swimming classes. They go to warm water exercise. They walk. They go to the library. They go to the theater. They just all over. In fact, one of our big major challenges, and Tom has been involved in that, is being able to provide sufficient transportation for those people who no longer drive to go. Just having that many vehicles and drivers available to take them to all the different places they want to go to participate is a problem. It's a good problem, but it is a problem.
So I want to ask you, Christine, in working with people who are in those very final weeks of life and helping people cross the threshold, how does that feel for you now as a retired person living in the same community that the people that you're helping are living in? Is that a difficult thing for you at all to be, I guess, closer to that stage yourself than you were?
No. Each day I work with people, helping them to look at that life's journey. It becomes easier for me personally as I go through that process. I hesitate to think now how many people I have actually been with in the dying process. It's in the hundreds over the years. And I feel it a real privilege that the family and the individual allow me to share this sacred moment of life, that so much happens in that time, the reconciliation. You see families come together. You see people look at what has troubled them, and sometimes they can't resolve it but can come to peace with it. I think the way in which we enable people to die with dignity today is much better. Our physicians are just marvelous in managing pain and, as much as possible, managing pain but keeping people alert when they can, surrounding them. We try as much as possible when a person is dying to have them in a private room, even if they haven't been in one prior to that, so that the family has space and can be present with them. We provide, the refreshments so that they're comfortable, so that it is. And the comment that Carla made about celebration, I think we really help people to celebrate the end of life. And to some people that may sound very strange, but this is a life well lived. It is a person well loved. And that next step in journey needs to be one that is of quality, of care, of compassion, of love, and peace and joy. And I would say, and it may sound Pollyanna to some people, but I've been there, and I would say that nearly all of our people die peacefully. And I've had family members who were very afraid of being present at their death and afterwards said, I don't know why I was so afraid. And I would hope that everybody can die like that.
Signe is on the line. Hi, Signe.
Hi. Good morning.
What would you like to talk about?
I've been a CNA, a nursing assistant, for 12 years, and I'm currently a nursing student and have worked in a lot of long-term care environments. And everything that's being said really resonates with me. I really like what was said about that we should treat the end of life as we treat birth and planning for it and being educated. And one of the big kind of buzz terms in the birth community right now is, if you don't know your options, you don't have any. And I feel like that really applies in this situation as well. And I also just wanted to kind of talk about where we're talking about making a transition, and it can be really hard for families and individuals to make the transition from living at home independently to 24-hour skilled nursing care. And if we're doing more planning and, you know, looking ahead, we could make sort of more of a gradual transition to, you know, assisted living and then skilled nursing care if you need it. but not having to have such a drastic transition, I think, would be beneficial to everybody. So just really like the conversation that's going on.
Well, Sydney, thank you so much for sharing your perspective. And we have a couple other comments that I want to get to as well. And Carla, this gets to something that we were talking about earlier, which is the inequality in death as well as life. And we had a caller saying that while assisted living is great, it's very costly. How can you die well with low funds?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did want to specify, too, that, in fact, assisted living is really expensive. But a lot of continuing care retirement communities are not as expensive because there's different funding strategies. And so you actually can go into most CCRCs, continuing care retirement communities, using Medicaid. And so I think that that's one of those things where it's not very well known what the distinction is between a standalone assisted living environment. And those are expensive, right? Like you have to actually have your own means to get into those places in continuing care retirement communities. So I think that's part of our education as these institutions become more diverse. We need to know the differences between them.
And is that right? A difference between a for-profit institution and a nonprofit
institution?
Oh,
that's a great question. We were talking about this yesterday when we were preparing to come see you. But another thing that you should definitely look for is you should look for nonprofit institutions. You might also want to look for organizations that are affiliated with faith communities or some other. What's striking about Winthrop House is it's not officially affiliated. It's not officially a religious organization, but it has this collective fund that means if you make this your home, then we can't kick you out, right? And so there's some places that have that kind of thing, but they also might have an affiliation with whatever your faith background is, if you have one, and that might also help with the cost. So I want to encourage, I mean, I think it's a very well-placed question, but I also want to encourage people to know that while I would kind of set assisted living off to the side as being not a great option for people with limited means, continuing care retirement communities are where they should put their focus. Okay. And know that even among those, there are a lot of differences in like funding opportunities
so
and who can
your
live
options.
There. Yeah,
explore
and you would be surprised how diverse people's backgrounds are by economics.
I don't know if we have 1 minute, but to follow up on that, our continuing care works when you work as a team. There are ways in which, through, as you have said, Medicare attributions, in the right facility, we make every effort with a lot of community people who find the money. So don't ever say, I can't go there because I don't have the money, because the right institutions will help you.
And I guess that's probably part of planning, too, mm-hmm. because if you can be your own advocate as opposed to waiting until you need another mm-hmm. advocate, that certainly eases the pathway, I would guess. One more comment. This is from Lisa in Cedar Falls. She says, I find it interesting that your program delved into retirement living during a program centered on a book about dying. Carla, I bet you were pretty surprised by that, too.
No, not at all. No. Because, I mean, to me, the two are very connected. So I talk about the longevity dividend, which is these extra 30 years of life that we all may be lucky enough to enjoy. But overshadow the way that we die now threatens to overshadow the incredible gift. And so you see Tom and Christine living these rich final chapters. And so it's about how the connections between how we live now are connected to, you know, the possibilities of how we should die now. So to me, planning an intentional death is very connected to living a rich final chapter, right?
Well, Carla, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity.
Carla Erickson is the author of the new book, How We Die Now, Intimacy and the Work of Dying. Reverend Christine Tinker, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for the privilege.
Christine Tinker is the spiritual care coordinator and a resident of Mayflower Retirement Community in Grinnell. And Tom, thank you.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Tom Evans served for 32 years as an ordained minister of the United Church of Christ, and he is also a resident at Mayflower Community in Grinnell. He served as their photographer and taught computer classes as well. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Ree, Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow is Horticulture Day. We're going to talk about the 13th Annual Iowa Organic Conference. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.